Behavioral Health Integrations podcast strives to inspire the next generation of mental health and addiction specialists. Our aim is to continue to raise awareness and encourage collaboration in the mental health and addiction industry so that it will continue to thrive. There are numerous approaches to treating mental health and substance abuse issues. On this show, we take pleasure in showcasing the diversity of these approaches used to improve the lives of others. So without further ado, your host, Jacob Minnig.
Hello, everyone, and welcome to another Behavioral Health Integration episode. Today, I have a very special guest for you. Her name is Paula Marucci. Paula is a licensed clinical social worker and a certified alcohol and drug counselor. Paula is a EMDRIA approved consultant and certified therapist in EMDR. Paula specializes in the treatment of families and adolescents with a focus in substance abuse prevention and treatment and trauma resolution. In this episode, we'll be going over many different factors of EMDR, as well as how it was, again, originated, who created it, and how it was created, and many more important questions as it comes to, do master level clinicians have the right to use it? What type of clients make good candidates for EMDR? What does EMDR do for the individual and how it improves individuals struggling with trauma and PTSD? And what are the differences between the many various types of trauma when it comes to PTSD or even complex PTSD? I, for one, am truly excited to get this episode to start. So without further ado, let's begin. Well, Paula, thank you so much for being on the show. I greatly appreciate it, and we're going to have a blast.
Excellent. I'm excited.
Yeah, so right off the bat, so you're in Chicago right now?
I am. I'm actually north of Chicago. I'm in a little suburb called Evanston. We call it Heavenston because it's so awesome.
Oh, yep. It makes sense. That makes sense. Wait, so did you always live in like Chicago or Illinois, or did you move around a lot?
You know, I moved around a lot as a kid, which would probably be part of my story. But I came to Evanston when I was 13, and then I have basically lived in Chicago and some of the surrounding suburbs where I raised my family. And I think I've kind of gone full circle because I'm back in Evanston.
Okay. Just curious, like, how are the resources like in Chicago as it comes to like counseling and therapy and treatment?
Well, you know, I don't really have anything to compare it to. So that's a really tough question. I'm a trainer and I train a lot of people. And I do online trainings, which gives me access to training across the country in Canada. And then I have local trainings that are geared toward therapists that are in Chicago. And it seems good to me, but like I said, I don't really have anything to compare it to.
Just in general, like, I would love to go to Chicago. Like, the only time I was ever there is when I was a baby for my uncle's wedding. So obviously I don't remember anything.
That doesn't count. Yeah.
Right.
Yeah.
Exactly. Exactly. I would love to visit Chicago.
You should. You're not that far.
I am not.
Right up the road.
Probably like 8 hours away, right? Because I'm in the Twin Cities. Yeah. So.
Yeah, actually, it's less. You can do it if you know. I remember I went to a conference up there, and you can do it in less than 8 hours.
Absolutely. That sounds great. So the main question to start off is, like, what actually got you in the therapy field? What motivated you?
Yeah, I didn't see this coming. This is my third career. I started in started in engineering, but then I went into business and finance. And so that was my forte.
So you're very smart.
Well, see, that's the thing. I have to plug you in. That's the thing. I wasn't smart enough to succeed as an engineer. It turns out I was dyslexic and nobody let me know or told me what to do about it. So, so then I went into business because I have the personality for it. Mm-hmm. So, from business, I ended up down in the financial markets because that's one of the things that Chicago offers us. And so that's literally where I started. Little did I know that I was a therapist down there because traders are in their amygdala and they need to be in their prefrontal cortex. And I was an excellent, trade assistant is how I started out. Because I would literally talk to the traders and calm them down, which is what I do for a living now. So it's kind of interesting. So, but how did I get here? Basically, trauma in my family, trauma in my background, addiction, kind of the same story as everybody else.
Yeah, no, just go back to your dyslexia. Like, was it like you like struggled reading or you saw the words differently?
Yeah, I'm reading, writing, you name it. I'm good with numbers, really good with numbers.
Okay.
So, yeah, reading a book's not my thing. Love podcasts.
Yes.
Thank you.
That's what I'm talking about. I'm the same way.
Yeah.
I mean, I don't have dyslexia, but I have like really bad ADD, ADHD. So I love audiobooks. I love podcasts.
Right.
I feel bad for like my guests who like send me their books. No, I mean, I love their books. I just struggle reading them. And it's not because they're not interesting. It's just that my ADD is hard for me to like sit and focus.
Yeah. Yeah. No, I hear you. That's why YouTube's awesome.
Oh, yeah.
Googling. Yep. Googling for summaries. Yeah.
So tell me about your grad school experience. Like, did they kind of encourage you to get like your addiction counseling certificate first, or did you more do like the mental health stuff first, then get the addiction stuff done later?
You know, it's interesting that you asked that. First of all, I went in and got my master's without I've never taken a psychology class. I have a business background, a science and math background. And so I was shocked when I got in. But with addiction, we didn't really talk about trauma and addiction. I never took a class on that. Now I don't want to date myself, but it really wasn't that long ago. And so I was actually part of the very first semester that they added the CADC program at Loyola. And I remember having to make that decision because it meant doing a third internship. And I was like, yeah, this is really important. And I can't imagine, you know, what my career would have been like without it, because addiction is everywhere, as is trauma.
And again, I don't understand why until like now they're just starting to like combine the two. And throughout all these years, there was such a strong separation between the two. And I don't understand why. And it's not just a Midwest thing. It's like a nation thing.
Yeah. Well, you're right. It used to be separated out. And now what we're finding is that addiction is just a continuation of how we medicate trauma. When you experience, and I think we're going to be talking about this in a little bit, complex PTSD, we dissociate. That's how our coping strategies kick in, and separating from pain, mental and psychological, is dissociation as a child. And then when we start using substances, it just gives us control over our dissociation. So you don't want to go after what helps the client, you want to go after what hurt the client, which is the trauma. So we're just starting to figure that out.
So are you in the belief that the majority of cases are caused by, again, mental health issues, trauma, and that a lot of people tend to use drugs to, again, mitigate the symptoms caused by trauma?
Yeah, I am. I do come from that camp. In fact, I think trauma really is at the bottom of everything. Everybody needs to be trauma informed now as therapists, after the pandemic.
Can I tell you something? Like, I love my grad school and everything. Like, I agree with you, but I will have professors, and again, this isn't necessarily wrong, but they tell me, oh, that's a common response, but the right response is you treat them together. And I'm like, okay.
Yeah.
Tell me I'm wrong.
You.
And I'm okay with the answer she gave as well. I just don't believe it. I think the root of a lot of the stuff is, again, like you said, mental health.
Right. Right. And we have to figure out the appropriate way to look at, you know, meeting the client where they're at, because if their symptoms are getting in the way of their functioning, like if you have a DUI and you've lost your driver's license, then we do have to look at the symptoms first, because we need to get you functioning, and then we can start looking at the trauma. So there's this assessment piece that's really important.
And do you think another issue is, how do I say this, but a possible conflict is, maybe I see that your experience in maybe working with the 12 steps?
Yeah, love 12 steps. I mean, I understand that there are a lot of issues with trying to get people involved in 12 steps. If you struggle with a higher power, or, you know, one of the things they say in 12 steps is, you know, don't go near the rabbit hole. Well, trauma is the rabbit hole. So yes, if you're not going to see a trauma therapist, don't go near that rabbit hole. But if you are willing to start looking at your trauma, that is the rabbit hole. And so do it with a professional.
But like you said, the 12 steps doesn't really have that mental health component to it.
It doesn't. No, you're right.
And through my experience, like working as a tech at treatment centers and even as an LADC, I'm going to just tell you right now, like 95% of the staff that I work with are in recovery. They are pro 12 steps, and it can be difficult to work with them sometimes when you come from like a mental health background as or a co-occurring like myself.
Sure. Yeah. But if you need sobriety, and you know, I love sober stands for son of a bitch, emotions are real. If you need that and you need to figure out how to work with your emotions, we do need that therapeutic component. But if you can't have it, I mean, I do stand by 90 meetings, 90 days, 90 phone calls, $90, 90% effective. I mean, it's a treatment that's out there. It's not perfect. And I understand that people have some issues with it. But if you go to your 90 meetings and you work with a sponsor and call them for 90 days, you will get sober. And so I don't know. It seems like a good trade-off to me.
There's a counselor talking about her father, who I believe is sober for a good amount of years, but it was the classic like white knuckling it, where the father would get extremely upset or angry if he was hanging around people and they talked about alcohol, or if there was alcohol in the area, he'd get pissed off and storm off. And it's just like, no, I cannot talk about it. I cannot be around it. It infuriates me, and he leaves. And yes, he does have a good amount of sobriety time, but again, is that a healthy way to live life?
Yeah. Well, isn't addiction in isolation, and recovery's in community, and there's nothing better than a community of people that get you?
Yep.
I've seen some really powerful meetings. I can't forget what that energy felt like. And that's not anything that I can reproduce in a individual session with a client.
Yeah. What's the fellowship?
Yeah. The fellowship.
Yep, the fellowship. Yeah. It's a very powerful, strong thing. It's community. And yeah, like, especially like in our treatment center, we talk about clients, we just inform them about how powerful it is to have that community and the people around you for that great, amazing support.
Yeah. Yeah. We all need that, no matter what we're struggling with.
Yes.
So yeah. So it's powerful. Let's move on to a topic that you really wanted to talk about.
Well, how did you hear about it?
Wait, how did
we can get into Frances Shapiro about her long walk by the lake, right? And
her eyes,
okay. Right? That's how she started it. And she's like, oh my God, this actually works with trauma.
Right. So we're talking about EMDR here. And EMDR.
Can I tell you something embarrassing? Can I tell you something? I struggle pronouncing it.
I
sometimes have reading issues. And I'm going to be vulnerable right now and just say F it, do it. Like,
go for it.
Movement. Desensitization and reprocessing. Okay, I did better than I thought I would.
You did.
My tongue on the desensitization. Yeah, see?
Yep. No, I struggled with that. I struggled with that for a while, and I'm actually...
You don't know EMDR. You can't even say it.
It doesn't work that way. Just call it EMDR. Let's jump into Francine Shapiro. You know, there are studies out there. You go outside, you're in nature, your eyes are darting around. And it's very therapeutic. Okay. We're not getting any more complex than that. It's just, you know, you're looking at the birds, you're looking at the trees, you're looking at the sky. But Francine, she was diagnosed with cancer and she was really struggling. And so she changed her focus in school to figure out how to work on her own mental health while she was struggling with her diagnosis. And so she was doing her research, and eye movements have been around for a long time because we experience them in our REM sleep every single night. So it's not like she came up with this, like, I'm just walking through the park and all of a sudden my eyes are darting around. It's, I want to see if this works. And it did. At the time in the 80s, PTSD was just recently a new diagnosis in the DSM-3.
1980.
And yeah, we needed something. And so people were just flocking in. Like, what is this? Because she did a dissertation that was very successful around, and it used to be called EMD, eye movement desensitization. And the key was that it would desensitize something that was distressing for a client, which it sounds like a gift, wouldn't it?
Its main belief is that we take in knowledge or the traumatic moment incorrectly in the brain. It's processed in the wrong parts of the brain, right?
Mm-hmm. Well, I should say it's stored maladaptively, and we need to get in there. If you think about being amygdala hijacked, you know, I go and I see something that triggers me, I become amygdala hijacked. I can't access my prefrontal cortex to think and to problem solve. So we use EMD or EMDR to desensitize what it is that triggers the client so they can use all aspects of their brain.
It's hyperactive. The amygdala is very hyperactive, and it's smaller. It shrinks over periods of time, right?
Yeah. So what else can I tell you about it? Because, I mean, I do teach it, and I use it with all my clients, and I receive it myself. So fire away with the question.
Oh, man. So right off the bat, let's go with the client. Well, you know, the funny thing is, from what I was told, once you get your master's degree in mental health counseling, you can perform any type of mental health intervention. The only one that ever scared me was if a counselor had the cojones to actually attempt EMDR, which sadly, I think there are, because of the emotional and traumatic damage you can actually cause a client without being properly trained. And the fear of being sued would be just like, nope, not even going to even try anything close to that. Nope.
Sure. Sure. And you're right. If you have a very powerful tool and you don't know how to use it correctly, you're right. You can do damage. So just do your due diligence and make sure that you're being appropriately trained and that you've got good consultation. You know, that's what I tell all of my trainees and consultees. You stick with consultation. We all should be doing that anyway, if we're going to work with clients that are, you know, coming in for trauma work, and the consultation will keep you on the right path, because each client's different. Each client has different reactions to trauma. They've got different symptoms. They've got different ways of medicating. So it's meet the client where they're at, but just also make sure you're taking care of yourself by being able to process your workload, your caseload, with somebody who can assist you with these tools.
So just curious, how many steps are involved in EMDR when working with the client?
Well, we call them phases, and there's eight phases. Yep, that's okay. You don't have to apologize. Phases. And so when you think about trauma work, we come from Pierre Genet's triphasic model. So we've got stages 1, 2, and 3 when we talk about trauma with the whole world. But EMDR therapists can fit into those three stages, 8 phases of work. And those are the 8 phases that we teach in the training. So it's broken down nicely, actually. Each phase is really important. And each phase addresses a different aspect of the work that we're doing. And so, yeah, it's a great kind of a ladder, I guess you would say. Nice structure.
So, again, I love trauma work. I did my thesis on veterans with PTSD, again, using exercise as an intervention.
Cool.
So veterans with PTSD and substance use disorders, and using fitness as a way to help them recover.
Mm-hmm.
So again, I'm a huge trauma fan, and I got this book that actually did a very good job, and I liked it too, about like a trauma map when working with clients. And I would love to hear your input on this. When you personally, as a responsible therapist, work with the client and you know a traumatic intervention might be involved or may be beneficial for the client, do you feel like there's maybe 2 paths you have to take right away? And the first one is, okay, how in tune is this client with their body? How well can they manage their intrinsic emotions? And if they can't, you don't go into trauma work. You go into maybe more interventions to help regulate their emotional system.
Sure. So the body keeps the score, did all the homework for us, right? Our body has our whole story. And you're absolutely right. A lot of our clients are not connected to their body. And so one of the things about EMDR that's really exciting is that when we activate, let's say, the eye movements, because there's many different action mechanisms, when we activate the eye movements, we activate the corpus callosum, which activates the right brain. So, and the right brain's connected to the body. So this is where EMDR can be a very powerful tool, because you're accessing the body and not necessarily getting permission from the client, because they weren't able to access their body when they first started working with you. So yes, we need to make sure that the client is aware of and gives us permission to access where that narrative is, you know, like they talk about in The Body Keeps the Score, because everything is recorded somewhere. Does that make sense?
I'm very interested. What are your skill sets to, again, apply that to determine their level of like knowledge in their body?
Well, I'm going to use a dissociative scale, like the DES, dissociative experiences scale, because technically, you know, one of the aspects of dissociation is depersonalization, which is a disconnection from your body. It is a leaving of the body. So that would be an example of how I would look at it from a trauma perspective. And once I can get the client to put language around what it's like for them to not be in their body, then we can start talking about how we can get into our body. So it's about the language, do a little bit of parts work. Yeah.
Oh, I'm just wondering what kind of questions you would ask them to, again, get those particular answers and awareness.
Some of the questions that are on the dissociative experience scale is, you know, are there times when you feel outside of your body? Are there times when you feel like you're able to observe yourself? Are there times when you feel numb or there's parts of your body that feel numb? There's specific questions that are asked that speak to, you know, do you feel that something isn't real? Do you feel that sometimes, you know, people are looking at you differently at different times? The questions are meant to be specific to how grounded is the client in their experience.
Yeah, no, that's very fascinating. Isn't it like another question too? It's kind of like also maybe this is getting more into PTSD, but again, how they personally view themselves in the world that they live in. What language do they use? It could be as broad as like the world is a sucky place. The world is a sad place, a dangerous place.
Yeah, no, you're absolutely right. And being able to use that language is important. One of the things we do in EMDR is we identify what we call the negative belief or cognition and the positive belief or cognition. And the negative belief or cognition is going to be that child part. It is going to be that part that says the world is not safe. I'm unlovable. I'm worthless. Yes. I'm inadequate. But the positive belief or cognition that we're aiming toward is the adult part. And the adult part is that I can be safe. I am lovable. I am worthy. You know, I can recognize what I can and can't control, which is something we utilize a lot with addiction. And so it's about shifting the client from the child aspect to the adult aspect. And so that's, you know, that's an important part of the work. And can the client, you know, if you're into like IFS is really popular right now, internal family systems, that child part, that wounded child part. And we do, you know, John Bradshaw was big with inner child work a long time ago. He was awesome. We need to heal that part before we can start even doing EMDR. So there's a lot of work before the work, we call it.
And I can imagine if you want to get a wounded child, just the fact, and I've been getting into this a lot in my lessons, is the shame and guilt and grief regarding the wounded child. I'm sorry, off-topic idea or thought process. But
No, you're absolutely right. I mean, we could do hours on this topic. All that language is something that's really important that our clients can utilize to share what their experience is like. So like I said, we can meet them where they're at and figure out what our treatment plan is going to look like.
I'm glad, again, you mentioned that. But another thing too, like when I work with clients, like in a substance abuse treatment center, and I speak to them about like the mental health therapeutic aspect of things, a lot of times, like they're afraid of therapists. They've had maybe therapists in the past that would leave them after like the client would express their story, or maybe get transferred off and it wasn't a good referral. Who knows?
Yeah, that's a tough one, right? Attachment wound gets triggered. Yep.
And I believe them. That's the sad thing is like, you know what I mean? You can't believe everything your clients like say, but it's like, oh, damn, I can actually picture that and it sucks.
No, you're right. You're right. It is. It's vulnerable, very vulnerable to go into therapy, especially trauma therapy. And especially when we've got these clients that have severe attachment wounds. You know, we haven't really talked about this yet, but PTSD, which is where a lot of the research is for EMDR versus complex PTSD are, you know, we've got to take that into consideration because complex PTSD is going to be about a child that didn't have a safety. They didn't have somebody that they could count on. They couldn't escape from their situation, whatever that situation was. It happened over and over and over again. So those types of wounds can be re-triggered in a therapy session if the therapist isn't careful. And so, you know, we've got some pretty big responsibilities with the work that we do. Once again, why consultation is super important.
But another aspect, and I'm glad you brought this up too, when it comes to like the chronic complex trauma, is there might be other disorders added onto that or other attachment issues reactive traumatic attachment issues along with PTSD and how it's just so different from one another. There's a lot more things you need to be considerate of when working with these clients in that.
Yeah, you're absolutely right. It's one of the things that I do appreciate, though, and I believe it was Dr. Stephen Porges who said that our job is pattern recognition. And once you start to wrap your brain around, my client has got so many patterns associated with what they learned growing up and what they do now. And once we can put language to that past present connection, it really helps us with the work that we're doing. And EMDR ends up becoming a tool that we integrate into that work. It's not just a therapy by itself.
Yeah. Again, I do have the mental health aspect to myself, but again, when you're working as an LADC, you can't apply your mental health skills because, again, like that's not your job. That's not your title. But again, I'll say things to try to calm my clients down about therapy and try to inform them. I empathize with your fear. I let them know right now, like the therapist that I refer you to or any good therapist is not going to go into your trauma right away. You need to, and again, I tell my clients, I hope you understand that because an important factor is when you're speaking and as a therapist, you need to be aware of this so much. This is almost primary. When you speak to a client and they're telling you your story or when you're trying to recognize patterns, they can get put into fight, flight, and freeze mode just by talking to you. That's why it's pivotal for you to understand, again, their knowledge and awareness around their trauma and how it affects their body. Because they could probably be in freeze mode, but still talking to you, which I was actually very surprised
Yeah, no, you're right.
by that
So,
aspect.
but let me ask you something because this is a huge controversy right now. How do you choose, or how do you know if a therapist does that or not? Because if somebody's trained to go right for the trauma, if somebody's trained to ask the client what was the most traumatic thing they experienced, you know, like there are a lot of therapists that might start that way. So how do you know?
I respectfully disagree with their therapeutic style. I'm not gonna, again, as therapists, we need to be good to each other. And I'm gonna respectfully disagree with that therapist style, therapeutic modality. And I would not respectfully refer to that therapist. And I know the therapist I refer to, but you also made an excellent point. I may not have time to, again, send a client to one of my referral sources. Honestly, Paul, I don't know. I guess I could look at their psychology today, but what does that really tell me?
Right. Well, that's my point because you have to be really careful about that because you don't want to re-traumatize them. You don't want to tell them that they're going to experience something that they might not experience and then have it be something that reminds them of what it was like to grow up in like an alcoholic home where they couldn't count on people. So to your point, we just have to know that it's complicated and like we want to honor meeting the client where they're at, but that you're right. There are a lot of different ways to do that. People have a lot of different trainings. And so it's really important that we all do our due
Well, let's just
diligence and make
admit there's
sure.
really shitty therapists out there. There's horrendous, evil, disgusting therapists out in the world.
There's horrendous
There's
evil discussing everybody out in the world.
but
So,
therapists, but in society, as therapists, we look at therapists a different way. And my God, I love the fact that I'm a therapist, but once you become one, and I don't want to get too off track, but like people look at your friends look at you differently, your family
Yeah,
looks at you differently.
true.
They're like, when I go on dates, they're like, are you analyzing me right now? It's
That's
always like,
exactly
oh
right.
my.
They feel like they're always being analyzed, which, to be honest with you, maybe they are. It's hard
Yeah,
not to
maybe you
think
should be analyzing
about.
me too.
Well, I'll try to stay away from
I've
that, but
literally had
it is.
women be hesitant dating me
It's.
because I was a therapist. They eventually started dating me, but it took them a long time to like, yeah, I told my mom about you, and the mom told me that he's gonna think we're crazy.
It's funny. No,
I
it's a tough one. Some people don't want anything to do with it, and other people are really intrigued. So,
Yeah, why can't I just be human? You human Paula, I'm human being Jake. When I leave the office, I'm just Jake and you're Paula. Like, that's it.
That's right. That's right. So, let me ask you a question. I want to kind of back it up to something that you said. When you talked about exercise, what exercise specifically were you talking about? Like, what is it that your clients like to do or ended up doing?
Like from a fitness or what
Yeah, from a
exercise?
fitness perspective.
Oh, it's funny you mentioned. So my thesis was again veterans. I actually, it's funny that you brought. I got into the field as a personal trainer. I was an undergraduate in River Falls, Wisconsin, in exercise science. So I got my BS in exercise science. But how I got in the field was I was a personal trainer at a adolescent treatment center, and I was giving the adolescent, like the boys and girls, like fitness workouts and exercises as again as part of the recovery. So do you mean like maybe like the interval exercises, the weight training, the cardio workouts?
Well, here's where I'm going with this. So if you're jogging, you're doing bilateral. If you're biking, you're doing bilateral. If you're swimming, you're doing bilateral. If you're lifting weights, you know, right, left, you're doing bilateral. So you may have just been doing the physical aspect, but I'm going to say that you are also doing the bilateral, which is an action mechanism that we use for trauma.
I've never ever thought about it
That's
like
what I'm
that.
here
That's very
for.
interesting. No, that's very, very interesting.
Go for a walk. It's bilateral. So it's very cool.
So I'm just curious, like, so when you meet with a client, like, do you ever decide a client is not a good candidate for EMDR at all, or just right now, and then you put them through, like, meditation workouts, DBT exercises? What's your approach in that?
So that, like I said, there's eight phases, and the first two phases, phase one is case conceptualization, where we literally contract with the client. You know, what is it that they're coming in for? And then the other piece is going to be stabilization, where we are not only teaching the client skills, but we're also assessing them. We are assessing them for how appropriate they are. And in our EMDR toolbox, we have many different tools. So we're always thinking about, let's see, what tool is going to be best for this particular client? So just like with substance use disorder, that assessment phase is really important to figure out like where we're going to meet the client and what tools are going to be appropriate for them in the moment. So if I have a highly dissociative client, you know, where I do the dissociative experiences scale, and for any of these tools that we're talking about, emdrchicago.com is my website and all the resources on there. So if you're like, what's the DES? What is dissociation? Just go to my resources, go to dissociation and check it out because it's really powerful. But if I have a highly dissociative client, I'm going to know that that client's not in their body. So if I go in and start trying to desensitize or reprocess a trauma memory and they're not in their body, you and I both know that's not going to work. They have to be in their body. So that client, I'm not going to go into my later phases, 3, 4, 5, and 6, until I can get them in their body.
So you see that by looking at their body language as well as maybe the assessment that you did earlier?
The assessment is so powerful, super powerful. And also I'm going to be kind of, I don't want to say testing, but we have what we call secure your space, peaceful place, and container. Those are like our three go-tos in EMDR. And we ask the client to try them. And as they're trying them, we are literally assessing if they can do it or not. And if they can't do it, it's just like you as a personal trainer. If they can't, then that means you need to work those muscles or the muscles around them to make them stronger so that they can do it. And if they can do it, then we're ready to move on to the next phase.
Okay, excellent. I got my next question for you. So let's just say a client struggles, we'll say in this language, to get to the next phase. So let's say you stop them at phase 2 or 3. The thing I love about EMDR is you could add other therapeutic modalities to it.
Fantastic. Yep.
So would it be possible to, again, maybe add like a CBT aspect to it to, again, maybe help them overall in general or move on to that next phase?
Absolutely. And that's what's beautiful, especially about the EMDR training that I do, or I should say we do at the company I work for. We integrate EMDR into what you're already doing. We're not like, hey, come on over and be an EMDR therapist and let's just throw all those expertise that you worked on for years away. We want to take the EMDR tools and figure out how to make them work for you. So if you're a CBT, DBT therapist, somatic experiencing therapist, that's what you're going to use. Now, my intervention of choice is polyvagal theory. I am a huge, huge, huge fan of polyvagal. It is the answer to everything in my world. So if I have a client that's not in their body, I'm going to teach them polyvagal so they can put language around and learn how to get back into their body.
Well,
so
they're not safe. That's the thing. Like their brain is detecting like they're not safe.
Yeah, that's right. Which is kind of cool that our brain could do that. But we can't go in and do trauma work if our client's already dysregulated because they're not feeling safe, which is what the pandemic did to all of us. So there's that.
They're not aware of like what safe actually really is in a sense.
Right. You're absolutely right. Yep.
There is like, again, I'm not the smartest guy in the world, but I think Porges had a really cool video that was actually simplified, nice 8-minute video that I actually understood. And I did this because it involves like a pyramid in your brain and the levels of functioning.
Yeah.
And how your brain, when it goes through like fight or flight, it shoots out blood to the rest of your body, right? So the brain, the blood in the brain leaves and goes to your body to, again,
goes to your muscles.
Yep. So again, like it cannot use all levels of functioning because it's so used to that process.
Mm-hmm. No, you're right. And Dr. Porges is probably, he's so nice. But you know what I want you, I email him. That's why I know
he emails back to you.
he emails me back, and I have no idea what he's saying because he's so smart. But he's just the sweetest guy. But
I'm not worthy to talk to him. I've been trying to get a hold of him.
Seriously?
No, I'm not saying he's a very popular man. I'm not saying anything bad about him.
Well, you would be surprised. He makes time for everybody. But I have homework for you. You ready?
Yes, please.
Okay. All right. You're gonna go to my website, emdrchicago.com, and you're gonna go to resources, and you're gonna click on polyvagal. Mm-hmm. And there are three links. I want you to click on the second one, which is the video that Seth Porges, his son, did. Seth is a comedian. And
he's not. Oh my
he
God.
Is.
Are you serious?
It is a great video. 35
I've never
minutes.
Heard of
I guarantee
Seth.
You will love Seth. Seth's awesome. And you will learn polyvagal in 35 minutes. I promise you. So
that is funny.
Go watch his video. And the three links that I have on there will teach you polyvagal. Okay, this is a little bit of an exaggeration, but in an hour. I'm like, watch the video and print the sheets and do them on yourselves. And you will know how to do polyvagal with a client in an hour.
I got his book that I used for my thesis.
And it's so not hard. Knowing,
huh?
It's so hard, his book.
Yes, I got it. And it's just like, these words are so difficult. I can't read them.
Yeah.
Because it's I mean, some of it's very interesting, but it's just like, it's so complicated. Like, I have to go to the dictionary and look up the words.
Yeah, no, I agree with you. I just there are smart people out there. You and I both know that. I'm more on the street smart side of things. But anyway, Seth is cool, and give him a shot. 35 minutes. I guarantee you it's be worth your time. You're going to love it.
Also, I'm very interested to know, because I looked up obviously your information on LinkedIn. You were speaking about a Judith Herman.
Oh, yeah. She's a classic. She's the one who actually introduced me to complex PTSD. Like PTSD, since the 80s, has been what everybody is focused on. But to be honest, our clients have complex PTSD. And her book, Trauma and Recovery, such a triggering book. I feel like I dissociated through it three or four times. But everybody should read it. Everybody should read it. She's phenomenal. Just a plethora of information. So, yes, I'm a huge fan.
Okay. No, that's great stuff. I'm going to have to look more of that information up. So also, I want your opinion on, as a therapist, to become certified, I know all places aren't the same, but you pay a particular fee and you go through like a week training, or is it more of a weekend thing?
So it depends. We like to provide whatever it is that works for you. We have 5-day training. So first of all, if you want to look up the trainings and this calendar, go to emdrconsulting.com. That's the organization. Roy Kiesling is our founder. He is amazing. Such a forward thinker. I the only one that I would work for. And so we have a 5-day that I do my 5 days Monday to Friday. Some people do the 5 days Wednesday to Sunday. So you can do what we call a one and done, which is 5 days. And that includes the consultation. You get everything done, and it's about $1,100 with everything included. Now, it's intense. I'm not gonna lie. It's intense. It's a lot of learning, but it's awesome. It's worth it. Worth every penny of it and every moment of your time. Or you can do a two-parter, which is Friday, Saturday, Sunday. We do part one, part two, so you can practice your skills in between. We usually do them about 4 or 5 weeks apart. I do those in Gurnee, Illinois, because I like to stay close to home. Yeah. But I also do them online, and online has been awesome. I'm so grateful for the online component now.
How do I, let's say if I want to do it right now in my room and I'm doing it online, how do I practice skills, like by myself or like?
So by yourself. So there are skills that you can practice by yourself. I always tell my consultees, if you don't have clients, there are very creative ways that you can practice. Okay. Just like I would say, go do the polyvagal charts on yourself. You can do container and peaceful place. But we do want you to have, we want you to have some people to work with as well, so that you can practice your skills. And what we want is 10 hours of consultation where you're on, like I did a consultation today, and you're on a call. I do 2-hour calls where you're just talking about cases, one case after another, after another, after another. And how do we integrate EMTR into the work that we're doing? How do we know if the client's in their body or not? What does polyvagal look like if we need to use it as an intervention? I mean, it's amazing. So how can we desensitize or how can we reprocess a memory? It's really, it gets right to the trauma.
Question, would you be willing to take payment plans?
Yeah, they do payment plans. I want to say through PayPal.
Okay.
Yeah, I think it's like a 5 months payment plan. Oh, we got it
all.
Oh
my God, that'd be perfect for me.
We're there for you. We are there for you.
Everybody here knows my financial situation now.
Yeah, but you got to do me a favor. You got to sign up for one of my trainings.
Of course. You would be the only one I would go to.
You're a great personality. I love good personality, sense of humor in my classes.
I would definitely do that. Absolutely. Like, and I also want your opinion on something else. Like, how do I phrase this? Like, it's not saying anything bad about, let's say, the newly trained EMDR therapists, but what are the biggest mistakes you see newly trained EMDR therapists making when working with clients?
Okay. So this would go back to one of the concerns that you've already brought up. If we go in, so just, you don't need to know too much about this, but there's three action mechanisms that we utilize when we're doing EMDR. And one of them is the eye movements. The longer you do the eye movements, the more trauma content that comes up. So the biggest mistake that a trauma therapist can make is to go in and target a very activating memory and do long sets of eye movements and not know that the client is just bringing up more and more trauma when they're already overwhelmed and shutting down. And that's where polyvagal can be very useful, because if the client knows they're shutting down and you know they're shutting down and you know what tools you need in order to avoid the shutdown, then everybody's in a better place.
Yeah, that's why I really respect both my supervisors, and she actually taught me, because sometimes when I do groups of trauma, one, like, her belief is too, like, she does not believe like traumatic groups can be beneficial unless you're teaching them coping skills.
Mm-hmm.
And because it kind of goes into the trauma-informed care, where especially in a treatment center, they're all at like different levels and phases of like their mental health journey, let's say.
It's true. That's true. Yep. Mm-hmm.
And when I think about trauma, I would assume like a client would be somewhat nervous about it. But sometimes, like, there's this one woman, I know, right? A male teaching a group of women trauma that has like shitstorm all written all over it.
Mm-hmm,
but anyways,
mm-hmm.
Just like, she kept talking about her trauma, but for some reason, I think she wanted to get all of it out, but she was kind of like in that freeze mode. But I assume, like, once you're in freeze mode, you're not talking, you're frozen. But she was talking more and more about her trauma. So that's why I was like shocked at first. I'm like,
But we call that under accessing. She's able to tell you everything about it, but she's not accessing the emotions that go with it.
She was froze. She actually did seem froze, but she was still talking and wanted to get it out.
She can just talk, but she's not really engaging with the story in her body, which is, what you've been talking about this whole time, right?
Also, what is your thought on a man doing a trauma group with a bunch of women? And she was
oh, gosh. Well, personally, I would love it. But, everything's triggering, right? It's
Thank you.
Everything. It doesn't matter. You could just you could have a therapeutic, like really nurturing, empathic woman doing it. And she brings up a car accident and all of a sudden you're triggered. Like, the point is, and once again, now I sound like a polyvagal therapist instead of an EMDR therapist. If you know what triggers you, then you know what to do if you get triggered. And with EMDR, we go in and we desensitize triggers. The work that we do is transformative. We call it a trait change. If you are triggered and you breathe and ground yourself, that's a state change. You've learned to change your state. But when we go in and use our tools, we are changing it permanently. And we can't change the memory, but we can change how you react to it. And it's a huge gift.
I think, and again, I understand why there needs to be same sex, this or that. I think in my example, a man doing a trauma group for a group of women could actually be extremely beneficial for some of them.
You're absolutely right. Yeah, you are so right. Because, I mean, there's the trigger, let's assume. And then how is the client going to regulate themselves? Or what is it that you can take to your individual therapist that say, hey, Jake just triggered the crap out of me when he was talking about this. And then the therapist is like, let's focus on that today.
The biggest like example I give is, oh, that man or that so-and-so reminds me of the man that raped me or physically abused me or sexually abused me and so forth.
That's a tough one, right?
But again, there's nothing I could do about that.
Right. I get told the same thing. So, therapist has the word rapist in there. I almost fell over when somebody pointed that out to me. And so my clients, some of them feel that when they're working with me, because they've experienced intense abuse, they say that they feel like it's rapey in the session. And I'm the abuser. So we are always taking that risk, because if our clients only know pain, they're going to seek out pain, and that pain may be working with us. So we just always have to take that into consideration. But it's all good. It's all what they say, grist for the mill.
I have to ask your opinion on this too. I will even like hear therapists who actually use EMDR on themselves. Is that possible?
Oh, this is a loaded question. Yes, it is.
But it's not the
finger. Yeah, wink, wink. Yes.
But it's not always just the finger, right? Like if you want to do it online, is there like a noise, a bilateral noise, or like a light you also do?
You know, I don't, you know, everybody's different. You know, I come from a little bit of an older school. I either like doing self-tapping because you're hugging yourself. I like tappers, and online, it's amazing how easy eye movements are. They're easier online than they are in person, if you can believe that. Using the online version, you have to be careful with that if you're doing it for yourself. But we're not really going to talk about like doing it on ourselves, right?
Right. Well, yeah. Yep. But wait, you mentioned like tapping. Is that similar to like the EFT tapping, like with your...
No, because EFT tapping is not bilateral. So bilateral is going to be left, right, left, right.
Okay.
Yeah. Okay. Whereas EFT tapping is just a tapping.
And that's like emotionally focused therapy?
Yeah. Yeah. I only recommend, the research is out on the EFT tapping that we call the butterfly tapping. I'm not trained in that, so.
And also like getting farther, deeper in this rabbit hole, like, have you ever heard of like the meridian tapping, like the meridian systems in the body?
There are a couple therapists that, you know, once again, our therapists are going to be trained in all kinds of stuff. We want to figure out how EMDR can assist them with what they're already doing, what's working for them.
What are your thoughts? Like, would you ever think, like, again, combining EMDR with other like therapeutic interventions, that some don't make a good combination with EMDR? Like,
no,
let's go
they're
with
all
like,
good.
Yeah, like one that I think it would be really good, but maybe you would have to work in different phases. What do you think about like the psychodrama therapeutic approach, again, mixed with the EMDR?
Love it. Love it. Let's say you're doing psychodrama and all of a sudden you get triggered. I'm going to run over there and I'm going to desensitize that trigger just by doing quick eye movements on you.
Would that be beneficial in the earlier phases then?
Desensitization is still going to be in the later phases, because you got to remember, now we're getting into a training here, that when you do any type of bilateral, you're going to activate memories. So for some clients, if they're not in their body, to your point, we don't want to activate any memories until we can get the client in their body.
Okay.
Yeah.
And that takes like a process, right? That doesn't happen. That could take days maybe, or multiple sessions.
Sure. It could take multiple sessions. You know, I think the assessment is the key piece, right? Because you can't just say, hey, client, are you in your body? Like, we need to assess that. And that's why I love phase two, because it's people think, oh, phase two, I'm going to learn my stabilization skills. But in fact, it's really the therapist assessing you to see how you're able to use your stabilization skills and if they work for you. Is there anything else that you need from me before we close this up?
No, that's pretty much it. But if any of my audience members want to get a hold of you, is there a particular website or email or LinkedIn they could use to send you a message?
Yeah, it's easy. emdrchicago@gmail.com, emdrchicago.com. My name is Paula Marucci, and you can find me on LinkedIn. I'm on LinkedIn a lot. Love LinkedIn. It's pretty easy to find me. Just send me an email. Ask me a question.
Absolutely. And again, all that information will be on the show notes and one click away.
Excellent. So glad that you had me. I love talking about this stuff.
I had
so
a blast.
Passionate about trauma and EMDR. Just it's a gift. And so I hope that all of you that are listening, you know, go in and empower yourselves with a tool that is priceless.
Amen to that. And thank you. It was truly an awesome experience learning from you.
Sure. Anytime. You know where to find me.
I again want to thank Paula. I had a blast having her on the show. I just want to thank all of my listeners for your support. And just to inform everyone that the information expressed in this episode was not meant to be taken as therapeutic advice. If you do find yourself struggling with any type of mental health or addiction issues, please seek the care of a medical doctor or a licensed mental health therapist. And if anyone has any further questions for me, you can reach me at my email address, behaviorhealthintegration121@gmail.com. You can also find me on LinkedIn at Jacob Minig, where you will find more educational posts on psychotherapy, trauma, and addiction. And finally, you can follow me on my website, which is behaviorhealthintegration.org. I also want to inform everyone that there is a great new device out there called Calmigo. It's a breathing device meant to control and manage your breathing rates and the depth of your breathing as you inhale and exhale to, again, help relieve any type of anxiety and stress-like symptoms. And if you do put the BHI podcast into the promo code, you get $30 off this amazing device. It is a once-in-a-lifetime deal, and you will not be disappointed. All right, everyone, until next time, have a good day. Bye.